Hello everyone, welcome back. Part two, or second podcast. Just want to, I forgot a few things last week, even though last week's was long enough. A few bits and pieces that I've jotted down in the meantime. Working at the BBC Transcription Service in the mid-70s onwards, one of the earliest pop music programs we did was called Top of the Pops. You've probably heard of that, but not this version. This was recorded and produced by Transcriptions, especially themselves, for radio stations abroad. I explained about that last week. So this was completely independent. If you were living in the UK at the time, it was completely independent from both the Thursday night television program called Top of the Pops and the Sunday night chart rundown. I think that was called Top of the Pops 2, which ended the week with, you know, the latest number one, etc., etc. Ours was always introduced by DJ Brian Matthew. You probably know him. He was a DJ for years, and he's passed away now. But he was a DJ for years and decades on the BBC. Good friend with the Beatles when they started. They all got on really well. You see lots of pictures of them laughing and joking around in the BBC studios when the Beatles were recording with him. So Brian fronted our Top of the Pops. And I think it was literally right from the very start in 1964. What happened was, obviously, someone at Transcriptions saw how well popular music was going, and obviously the main thrust of that was obviously the Beatles, and decided to try out a weekly Top of the Pops disc for Transcriptions. And to that end, we actually produced two pilot episodes, which were sent out to radio stations for free, just for people to listen to, the radio station managers to listen to, and to gauge their thoughts. They were called Top of the Pops. They didn't have an episode number. And they were called Top of the Pops 00 and 0. And when I joined in 1976, we still had about 15 copies of Top of the Pops 0. In the end, I did find library copies of 00, and it was the same program pressed on both discs. So I don't know what the difference between 00 and 0 was, but it was a full, I think it might have been maybe 45 minutes in total across two sides of the disc. Brian Matthew just interviewing and playing the latest chart hit parade. But the thing about it was, very early on, was that all the music, I think I can safely say that early on, I don't know how long it lasted for. It couldn't have lasted that long. But all the music that was played on those discs were BBC recordings. They weren't the records. So if you had Cilla Black singing You're My World or whatever her latest single was, it was a BBC version. It wasn't a normal, it wasn't taken off the disc, off the release disc. So on Top of the Pop 0 and 00, we had three live tracks by the Beatles, and an interview. In fact, it was one interview with Brian Matthew, but it was cut up into two pieces. Sort of the first part was 3.5 minutes, and the second half was sort of 2 minutes. Obviously recorded at the same time, but just chopped up. And they were talking, and I can tell you when, it was done during the time of A Hard Day's Night, filming and recording, because the songs on there were Hard Day's Night, Things We Said Today, and another track, I think, off the Hard Day's Night album, which was brilliant because, you know, we had spare copies literally lying around because they were of no use now in 1977, because the programme had been going for, what, 14 years by then, so you don't want, people wouldn't want those, so they were just lying around. So when we sort of found the little stash of them, we took them home to listen to. And it had Manfred Mann on it, I think. I can't remember who else. It might have been Herman's Hermits. Whoever was current in, I don't know, mid-64. So that was great, you know, because at that point in 77, no Beatles BBC recordings had ever been released, and they were hardly heard of either. You know, they weren't played off, you know, there was no special programs highlighting the BBC recordings of the Beatles or anything like that. And you certainly, I mean, no one was inclined at Radio 1, say, to go and search out some old Beatles tapes and play them. It was just not relevant. So we fast now forward up to, as I mentioned last week, I was in the, excuse me, I was in the transcription tape library from about 81 onwards, a bit earlier than that. And we used to wipe tapes. And at one point, I did a wiping list, as I explained last week, for the pop music producer, Pete Dauncey. And what used to happen was some of the people would help in the would help. And they would actually come down to the library and just do the job, half the job themselves. They would go through the shelves and just pull out tapes halfway and come back into the office and say, Gary, the ones I've pulled out, make a list of. We're going to wipe them. And so you made up a list, sent it up to him, and then he would say, yes, wipe all of these, and then we'd do the job. Well, Pete did that one time, and I don't know why he went all the way back to the master tapes for Top of the Pop Zero, which I already knew had live Beatles on it and interviews because I had the disc. And, of course, my first thing was, and these were still in their red Emmy tape quarter inch boxes from 1964. And for some reason, Pete pulled these tapes out to wipe in sort of 1981. I couldn't understand why. Anyway, I knew instantly what was on them. And of course, what was the first thing I did? I just quietly pushed them back onto the shelf. And obviously, they weren't on the list when I sent them upstairs to be, you know, to be actioned for wiping. And obviously Pete never realised and never remembered, and they stayed there. And in fact, I did put on the boxes at that point. I thought, oh, what would have happened if it hadn't been me compiling the list of wiping tapes? Someone who didn't know could have just pulled those tapes out and they would have been wiped. And they would have been gone forever. So I then marked up all the tapes with a very big black marker pen, please keep do not wipe across the sides and the front, and they weren't, and of course, what, 10-12 years later, guess what, yet all of those recordings were used in the Beatles Anthology 1 double album. So you could say it was down to me that we've still got those recordings in pristine quality. Anyway, so that was good. So we've got those tapes are still around, thank goodness. Let's just go through my notes here. So that's that. And of course, we didn't have in the tape library, going back that far, that many tapes, literally 5 or 6. Some of them, most of them, I never heard. I should have taken them out and just listened to them for a start. There was certainly a 66 session by The Who, which was, I think, 6 tracks, 6 songs. But the one I remember was a 1967 Radio 1 session by Jimi Hendrix Experience. These have all now been released. I really should have listened to the, and maybe got a copy of the Hendrix session, because it was, he did a recording of Theme 1, which was sort of the Radio 1 official theme tune, if you like, and a couple of, and I think it was 4 songs a band will be contracted to record in one session. Spanish Castle Magic was on it. I can't remember what else, but I do remember there were 2 extra tracks which were just jams and instrumental and bits and pieces, but which I don't know whether have been released on Hendrix at the Beeb or whatever they put them out on. There were 2 jams, instrumentals, you know, playing around. But the drummer on those 2 tracks, because the engineer at the time in 67 had noted it on the log inside the tape, the drummer was Stevie Wonder. who must have been in town for some gigs or something. So I bet that sounded good. They've probably been released. Perhaps someone can comment on the bottom of this and say, yes, they were released in 1982 or whatever. But that tape was still around. As I say, there were the two Beatles, there were the two Top of the Pop Zero tapes, the Hendrix and the Who. And do you know what? I think that was it for 1960s. Can you imagine that? The whole decade was represented by four tapes. And next to it, then we're getting into the 70s where I remember, and I never listened to them, they were the original 8-track, 1-inch tapes of Queen at Hammersmith Odeon, which was New Year's Eve. Was it 76? It was an old Grey Whistle Test TV special as well, but we recorded it on our mobile on 8-track audio. I know that's been released. So that was nice. I never heard those tapes, but obviously that is the complete concert. They probably released that now since. I don't keep up with these things. But one of the other things we had in regards to comedy was we had the last Goon show of all. And it was, again, it was 8-track, 1-inch recordings. And it was either 4 or 6 tapes. As usual, each reel was 30 minutes long at 15 IPS. And I certainly know that on tapes 1 and 2 was the dress rehearsal in the afternoon before the recording in front of Princess Anne and all that. And you've probably seen the video of it. I think maybe those 8 tracks were actually used on the special CD release. Dirk Maggs will be able to help me with that. Because I've actually seen a picture of his with him in the BBC suite playing those 8 tracks. And you can actually see my writing on the spine and on the tape boxes saying, please keep, do not wipe. These things were important. So we had those just sitting around, you know, because Transcription had issued the program in a different edit to the Radio 2 audio version, and certainly in a much, much longer version than the television version too. So that was all good. That was all good stuff. You know, you were getting stuff that other people didn't have. So I do... going forward a little bit to 75, when I mentioned last week going to see the Monty Python and the Holy Grail at Hammersmith Odeon during the summer holidays, I do remember that the... and I'd never seen it before, and I don't think I've ever seen it since. There was a support film for it, and it was the... it was The Goons, The Case of the Muckinese Battle Horn, which I thought was really quite funny, and I've never seen it since. That's probably on DVD now too, isn't it? But that was good. And, you know, can you imagine laughing out loud when there's 6 people in the entire audience? So that was an unusual experience. Just keeping with The Goons, one of the tapes I liberated, if you want to call it that, while I was still at Transcriptions, there was a shelf of tapes right down the very, very back of the library. And these weren't master tapes or non-master tapes. I explained about those last week. These were, we called them domestic tapes. So they would be from Radio 1, Radio 2, Radio 3, Radio 4. But for some reason, they'd sort of stayed at Transcriptions at Kensington House rather than been returned to where they belonged. And that, in amongst them, there was a really old brown box with a tape in it. And it had no number on it. It had no title on it. There was no tape log inside it. But the reel was absolutely full up. A 10-inch, 15 IPS reel was absolutely full up. The tape actually would, if you pulled the tape out, the reel out of the box, the tape would actually spill out off the reel. It was so full. And if you know your tapes, if it's a 30-minute tape, it's not as much as that. There's not that amount of tape. And, of course, then when I looked at I wish I had a picture of it. We didn't have camera phones in those days. On a really small label, in very faint pencil, it just said Goons. And that was it. No date, no nothing, no, you know, title of the episode, nothing. So in the end, it got to a point where I thought, do you know what? When I leave here, which I eventually did, someone at some point is going to come down to this shelf, look through these tape and go, we don't want any of these. This is, we don't know what they are. Throw them away. So I took that one home. And now you fast forward to 6 or 7 years ago, literally that tape, and I never had a machine, ever had a machine that can play 15 IPS tapes. I never could afford one. So that tape, amongst all the others, was upstairs in a cupboard, just sitting there for all that time. It was never played. And when we decided to emigrate to Kenya, I got in contact with my friend Keith Wickham, who does all the audio restorations for Radio 4 Extra for comedy things. He does an amazing job resurrecting episodes that have been edited down over the years, and he puts the stuff back, and then you finally get the proper length episode. So I sent it to him. I said, Keith, have a listen to this. I don't know what it is. It says Goons. It might be blank. I said, the only thing about it is it's full. The reel is full, which is very unusual. So yes, he played it, and he got back to me within 4 or 5 days. He said, Gary, it's the Goons. It's the dreaded batter pudding hurler of Bexhill-on-Sea. He said, and it's 5 minutes longer than transmission. I've gone, what? He said, yeah, there's a scene in the middle that they cut out completely, sort of 3 minutes. And there are some other bits and pieces that were edited out, you know, on the transmission version. He said, this is another copy. It sounds like it's, you know, done somewhere else at the BBC, either surreptitiously or, you know, officially. But it's never been used, and he said, and it's never been heard. And apparently they did play it on Radio 4 Extra, and I got a credit on the BBC website about 3 or 4 years ago, and they finally transmitted it on Radio 4 Extra in the longest version. So that was nice. You know, in fact, I've never heard it. I still haven't heard it. I'll have to get on to Keith, give me a copy, just so I can listen to it, finally, after all that time. Talking about comedy and early 70s, one of the programs I forgot to mention last week that I really, really used to enjoy was Up Pompeii with Frankie Howard. I thought that man was one of the funniest people I'd ever seen. And my parents hated him, didn't like it at all. And it wasn't sort of childish comedy, I didn't think. It was just tickled my fancy. And I, even in the late 90s, when he made a big comeback, and I went and saw him at the Lyric Theatre in Hammersmith with his sort of comeback live show. And he was still doing all the early 60s, a few sketches and songs that, my goodness, I'd completely forgotten about. And he was still doing them. And he was still uproariously funny. Just brilliant. In fact, I think I went to see that show twice. I loved it. I mean, all the asides, the sort of, you know, you think ad lib bits, but they obviously weren't. He'd obviously used all that sort of stuff for decades. And it wasn't a sort of young audience just discovering him at that point either. It was a lot of older people that knew him from first time round. And wasn't it Peter Cook who resurrected his career by getting him a gig at the Establishment Club in the early 60s? So fair play to Cookie. Yes, I used to love Up Pompeii. I haven't seen one in ages. I'd probably look at it now and think, oh my God, this is dreadful. But I haven't. So probably maybe the memories are probably better than listening to it these days. So, okay, let's go on to some studio recordings, and we'll talk about 40 Towers. Like I did last week, I actually went to, I've now looked it up, I did mention it, but I went to 3 recordings in series 2, which was The Psychiatrist, The Kipper and the Corpse, and Anniversary. But going back to series 1, I was still at school. And I remember, and I think it was The Hotel Inspectors, which had been episode 1, with my father, Sunday night, probably BBC Two. I can look that up. And at one point, I can't remember at which point, it was so funny. It was so funny, I was lying on the floor, with laughter. I could not believe how funny this programme was. It was so good. So then we fast forward to 1979, and I'm now working at Transcriptions, and I can get hold of the monthly ticket list. And now, when you applied for tickets, if you were staff, you were limited to only two per inquiry. Even though I would have loved to have written in and said, can I have two tickets for every 48 hours recording, please? That wouldn't have gone nowhere. So you didn't even bother. In fact, I think it did say on the ticket list, limited to two per person. So what we did, if it was something that I really wanted to go, I used to get some of the other guys in the office to write off as well. So we did that for 48 hours. A friend of mine, Andy, that I work with, we wrote off, because they would specify on the list the recording dates. So I would reply, apply for one date. Andy would apply for another date. And one of the other guys in the office also applied for another third date. And we got all three, which was unbelievable. So, and then Paul, the other guy, he took them out of the envelope. And we've gone, all right, Paul. And he said, yeah, there you go. So Andy and I went, we pulled our resources and we went to all three. As I say, so Psychiatrist, Kipper and the Corpse and The Anniversary. A Beatles connection in one of those episodes. Can you tell me which one it is? I'll tell you now. In the Kipper and the Corpse, the man that played the corpse, Derek Royal. There's a Beatles connection with him. I don't know whether you realise, but he played Jolly Jimmy, the courier, on the bus in Magical Mystery Tour. So that was fun. That was a good episode. And the episode I think it's The Anniversary, and it's right towards the end of the episode. Now, do you remember Brian Hall? He played the chef in Series 2. I remember him. While the recording was going on, he actually came up to the back of the audience because he'd obviously finished his scenes, and he just came up to the back of the audience. For that recording, we had tickets that were only about five rows from the back, which was not sort of optimum viewing. But I noticed him come up. He still had he hadn't changed. He was still in his costume, you know, the chef's costume. And he came up and back and just leant there on the back and just watched the last 20 minutes. And there's one scene it might be in The Kipper and the Corpse saying that, where Basil bursts into one of the guests' rooms unannounced. I think they've got the corpse in the laundry basket by that point. Yeah, it could be. And the guest is standing there blowing up a sex doll, a blow-up doll. And sort of Basil, oh, sorry. And then just close, and that's it. But Brian Hall found that scene so funny. He was laughing out loud. That was really nice to see a cast member, lapping up the programme. So that was good. I do remember The Anniversary. If you remember, there's a scene where Polly impersonates Sybil in the bedroom, in bed, and sort of puts one of her wigs on and dark glasses to make out to the guests that it is her, even though it's not, because Sybil's done a runner and walked out. I do remember there was a lot of retakes in that scene. I can't remember why now, but it was just, for some reason, it was a difficult section to film, that one. And the last thing I do remember is, of course, in the initial run of recordings for Series 2 of 48 Hours, they only did five out of the six. Because if you remember, there was a strike, and Basil the Rat was filmed and recorded 5 months later. I couldn't get tickets for that because obviously, you know. So that was that. But I do remember at the end of, I think the last episode we saw recorded was The Psychiatrist. And I remember at the end of it, everything had finished and the studio manager came up to the audience and said, oh, ladies and gentlemen, before you go, John has got to record a little trailer. So if you'd just like to stay in your seats for the next 5 minutes, then we're completely finished. And Cleese on the set of Reception, where the telephone was, if you remember. You've probably seen this now. He actually recorded two different trailers for Not the 9 o'clock News, which was on the following week. And it was there's one I've seen, and it's not the one I remember. Maybe the other one's gone missing after all this time. But I remember him. The phone rings and he picks it. Yes, 40 Towers. No, we're not on next week. It's something else. It's not now the 9 o'clock News or something. Anyway, yes, it's some sort of review program. Thank you. And he just slams the phone down. And that was it. And I don't think that's the one that's now available either on YouTube or even the DVD Blu-ray boxes. I think the other trailer has survived. But I do remember him doing two different ones. So I'm going to now take you back to a lovely story with one of the people that I used to work, a guy named Derek Darley, who's no longer with us now. He was in at Television Centre when I was in VT Current Operations. He was there. He was much older than me. And Derek was there, maybe, actually, I've not thought about it, as early as the mid-60s. He was certainly there in when this story happened in 1970, because I've looked it up, and I think it's April. So he's working late, because we used to work till midnight. But it was late, but it wasn't that late. It was maybe 6:30, 7 o'clock, whereas virtually everyone has gone home by then. So he was virtually on his own in the office. And we used to have the door to the office open because people just used to walk in quickly and collect tapes and stuff and walk out and go round to their VT channels. And he was working away at the paperwork for the next day. And a guy pops his head round the corner and says, "Excuse me, mate, can you tell me how to get to the canteen?" And Derek sort of looked over his shoulder. He was busy writing some stuff. And he said, "Well, actually, if you give me 5 minutes, if you just wait," he said, "I've got to go to get some dinner in a minute. And once I've finished here, I'll take you out there." "Okay, thanks." So the guy stands outside. Derek finishes his paperwork. And he says, "Okay, come this way." And it's the guy here with sort of glasses and a beard. And a woman with him, and they walk, they go and have a chat. It's maybe a 10-minute walk from the office over to the two canteens. So they walk over, Derek's having a chat with them. Don't know who they are, they're just a couple. And so having a chat, and they walk into the canteen, and Derek says, "Okay, here on the right you've got hot meals, you've got sort of salads and stuff on the left, and down the far end is your dessert, and you pay at the other end." And they sort of say, "Well, thank you very much." Okay. So Derek goes and gets his tray, gets his evening meal. And there's a few guys there from the office who are already there, sort of nearly finished or still eating. So he walks over, puts his meal down on the table. And one of the guys says, "Derek, who was that you walked in with?" And Derek said, "Oh, it's just some guy. He came into the office, asked where the canteen was. So I brought them over." And the guy says, "Do you know who it is?" And he goes, no. "Why?" He said, "Derek, that's John and Yoko. Lennon was in, they were there to do Instant Karma on Top of the Pops." So that was Derek's claim to fame for not recognising John Lennon. Fair play to Derek. When you see John, he just had all his long hair cut off and his beard trimmed after sort of, a year of being really long haired, like on the Abbey Road cover. So whenever I watch the video of Instant Karma on Top of the Pops, I think they did three versions, because I think there's one version where Beatles roadie Mal Evans is playing bass and there's one where he's playing tambourine for a start, something like that. But don't forget, if you do watch it, and it's a good one, John is singing live. He's not miming. The backing track is the record, but he's singing live. And you think, oh, what a loss that was, not seeing John doing a solo concert tour ever. Anyway, there you go. So that was Derek Darley's claim to fame, not recognising John and Yoko. So Derek never dined out on that story, but we pulled his leg quite a lot. Even 15 years later, he was still getting stick about that. but Derek was a lovely guy. We do miss him. Going back to some comedy. I can't remember now. It was a few recordings of The Young Ones. And in fact, I went to the very first episode, series 1, episode 1. Now, Did you know, they used to have bands in the programme performing a single or a latest track, whatever, Motorhead, whatever. But I only got tickets because I liked the band that were going to be on. I'd somehow found out in advance who it was going to be. Not because of the comedy, but because of the band. And of course, once we got recording the show, it was like, this is brilliant. And the band on that episode was Nine Below Zero, who were one of my favourites for ages. I used to love Nine Below Zero. So that's the reason I went to the first Young Ones recording, not because of the comedy and because I wanted to see the show. It was because the group that we're on. I went to a few recordings of Old Grey Whistle Test specials, only two or three. In fact, it wasn't even that many saying that. There's one here I've got written down, but it wasn't a Whistle Test. It was a Sight and Sounding concert. And I went to Loud and Wainwright III at Golders Green Hippodrome. I didn't know anything about him, and he was okay. Not quite my sort of thing. But the problem was, not the problem, but was if on the ticket list, it would come up as an Old Grey Whistle Test special. And you thought, oh, okay. Or Sight and Sounding concert. But they wouldn't announce who the group or the artist was going to be in advance. So with the Whistle Test special that I went to at the TV theatre, you don't find out who the band is until you get in. And once you get in, you can't come out. So it was a real disappointment. In 1977, I went to a Whistle Test special, and it was Larry Coryell's 11th House, which was a huge jazz thing. And I don't really like jazz. So you had to sit there and bear it for the full hour and a quarter while they were performing. They were very good, but, you know, not, just not my thing, which is a shame. And same again for Sight and Sounding concert with Loud and Wainwright. Didn't know his stuff, and it was all right. But, I'm afraid not the sort of thing I recorded when it was on air, which is a shame. But there you go. You can't have everything, can you? Some of the other recordings. A Whistle Test, but normal studio Whistle Test would not have an audience. It would just be the studio, the film crew, the camera crew, and the band, and Bob Harris. And that was it. There was no one else in the audience. I got to know the PA on the band because she knew I was into music, and she would sometimes ring me and say, Gary, who did this? Or, do you know if we've got a copy of this? A promo film or something like that they wanted to use. So I used to ring her up if I could find in advance a band that I liked that were going to be on the Whistle Test, but no audience. So I managed to get into, and I've looked it up in the past week, it was October 1978, my goodness, I wasn't even 21 at that point. And it was Whitesnake, carrying on from my Deep Purple fandom. But this was the lineup with, they just had John Lord from Deep Purple on keyboards join, so that was a bonus. And they did Trouble, and a couple of tracks from their latest 78 album Trouble and Lie Down. But I remember, and of course there was no way I could get a copy of the sort of studio session tape, but I remember they warmed up with a Tom Jones song, It's Not Unusual, and I would have loved a copy of that. It lasted about 2 minutes just playing around, but it was just brilliant. And I think I and one of my mates were the only two in the studio apart from the band, the film crew, and Bob Harris. I was also there for Blondie's debut, because I used to like Blondie. And they did I'm Always Touched by Your Presence, Dear, that session. So I was there for that. And we also went to Andy and I, the guy who I went to 40 Towers with. He still likes Elton John. And we were there when Elton did A Song for Guy live on the Whistle Test. And I remember we did have a chat with him in the corridor before he went into the studio. Elton was a nice guy. You could talk to him, about music, and you could certainly talk to him about football. So that was nice, to have basically a superstar standing there with a cup of coffee in his hand having a chat about Saturday's game. I'm not a Watford supporter, I'm a QPR supporter, but you know, it was just nice to stand there and be you know, find out that he's a normal bloke at that point. And last thing, we're hitting 35 minutes, which is not a bad duration today. We nearly finished, everyone, don't worry. Last thing was, I kept, and I've only kept one of my 40 Towers tickets. I wish I kept the other two. I think I actually stuck them to the inner sleeve of the, do you remember before video cassettes, they used to release the soundtrack on record, on albums, officially, BBC. And I think I probably stuck those tickets to the inner sleeve of those albums. And of course, they're long gone now. But I still kept one. And about years later, so the recording was 79. It's got to be 10 years later, I think. Cleese was on Wogan. And it must have been just before I left. And I got wind of him being on, and so the day of it, I took in my pocket the 40 Towers ticket. And yes, during the afternoon, obviously during the tea break in the rehearsal, I met him in the tea bar. I think it was blue or red tea bar on the first floor. And I sort of sidled up to him and said, "Oh, excuse me, John, could you sign this for me?" And he looked at me and said, "Oh, yes, of course." So he signed it for me and he said, "Oh, which series is this?" He said, "Series 2. And he said, "Which episode?" And I've gone, "I don't know." I told him which three I went to. He said, "Oh, yeah, you did pick some good ones then." So that was nice. So John, he was okay. You know, I was obviously staff rather than sort of public, and he was okay with it. I think he's okay anyway, even now. So that was nice. And I've still got that. I haven't framed it because I don't want it to fade in the sunlight. So it's kept safely in an envelope in a drawer. So that's nice. It's probably, not being big-headed, unique. An actual 40 Towers autograph ticket. Anyway, there you go. So that's that. So that's the last thing we'll sign off on. Hope you enjoyed this week. Tell all your friends, will you? Don't forget to like and subscribe and whatever they say on YouTube these days. And download it, whatever. Anyway, if you've got any comments, you know, please comment and I'll always answer them. This is just a bit of fun for me, and it sort of reawakens memories of bands and people I've seen in the past. So there we go. So hopefully I'll do another one in a week or so, or when I've remembered a few more bits and pieces. And I might even try and get a guest on the next one. But we'll see how it goes. Anyway, thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. All the best. See you soon. Bye-bye.